Good morning, everybody. It is September 7th, 2021. This is your daily homeroom, your home away from homeroom podcast. I'm your host, Frank, coming to you from the heart of the Adirondack Mountains. Since this is our first published podcast, I will mention that I am a teacher in exile this year. I've been teaching for 25 years, but I am not allowed in the classroom this year, even though I have an ADA exemption for mask wearing. I'm fully vaccinated. New York State will not let me come into the classroom. So here I am, and I am glad to be with you on the Daily Homeroom Podcast. Let's begin, as I have begun every day of my 25-year teaching career, with the science fact of the day. Today's slogan is Sweet Fact Align. Bum, bum, bum. Yes, I cannot sing well, but there are many things that need to be done, even if you can't do them well. Today's science fact today is, why can you hear around corners but not see around corners? After all, light and sound are both waves, right? Well, yes, that's true, but they have very, very different properties. They're very different types of waves. Light is an electromagnetic wave, of course, alternating series of electric and magnetic fields, whereas a sound wave is a mechanical phenomenon, a disturbance of the matter. This is why you can have the slogan for the movie Alien be that no one in space can hear you scream, or in space no one can hear you scream, because there is no matter to be disturbed out there. You can't propagate a mechanical wave. However, an electromagnetic wave can travel through a vacuum, can travel through space, because it's just, as I said, a series of alternating electric and magnetic waves. Good thing it can, too. Otherwise, light and the energy from the sun that comes to us in electromagnetic waves would not be able to reach our planet from the sun. It turns out, though, that for seeing around corners and hearing around corners, or seeing through a doorway or hearing around a doorway, it's actually the length of the wave that turns out to matter. This is a phenomenon called diffraction. And sound waves can diffract around corners. Light waves cannot. So, for example, if I'm here in this side of the doorway and I shine a laser shooting through the doorway, it just makes a dot on the far wall. And if you're standing around the side of the doorway, the laser will not bend around and put a red dot on your chest. But if I talk and you're standing around the corner or around the doorway from me, the sound will diffract and reach your ears. It turns out that what matters for diffraction is the length of the wave. A light wave, right? A blue light wave is about 400 nanometers, 400 times 10 to the negative ninth meters. So that means 400 billionths of a meter. That's a very short wave. And a red light wave is about 700 nanometers. Whereas sound, the middle C on a piano, for example, is about 1.5 meters long. And it turns out that barriers, like doorways, they can cause waves to diffract, or waves can diffract through the barrier if the size of the barrier is smaller than or comparable to the wave size. So sound waves, being about the same size as a door, can diffract through a door. But light waves, being billions of times smaller, cannot. That's why you can see around you can hear around a door, even if you can't see the person through the doorway that's speaking to you. But this leads to some other really interesting phenomena too, by the way, like a lightning strike, right? You ever hear a lightning strike really close to you? It sounds different than if lightning is really, really far away from you. Lightning strike super close to you sounds like a crack, and it's like a sharp crack, snap. But if it's very far away from you, you just get that low rumbling thunder sound. And this is related to the diffraction, because the lightning strike far away from you, the sound waves that reach you have to be the sound waves that can roll around barriers and over the trees and through the mountains and reach your ears. So those are going to be the longer wavelength sound waves, and that would be the lower pitch. Whereas if the lightning strike is right near you, the higher pitch, higher frequency sound waves, shorter wavelength, can reach your ears. So you hear it differently. You hear it as a crack. Same thing with how you set up your speaker equipment, right? You ever see that subwoofer under your seat in your car, or a subwoofer down on the ground somewhere in an audiophile's listening room? Well, that is allowed because the subwoofer has such a long wavelength that its sound waves can reach your ears by diffracting around barriers. No problem. Doesn't matter where you put it. But the higher frequency, higher pitch speakers like your tweeters, you want those more at ear level so they can reach your ears with no barriers between the speakers and the ears. So there you have it. That's today's science fact of the day. That's why you can see around corners. You can hear around corners, but you can't see around corners. And it's because of the length of the waves. The barrier has to be smaller than or comparable to the length of the waves. So sound waves being a meter long, they can diffract around corners. You can hear someone around a corner, even if you can't see them. Light will not diffract around corners because its wavelength is much too short. All right, let's get in now to our format. We have a format where we're going to do commentary on the news for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we're going to do a deep dive into a certain subject. Today, and for our first week here or so, we're going to talk about things that are unseen in the Bastiat sense. So we'll talk about that when we get there, a deep dive into some big ideas. But first 20 or 30 minutes, we're going to do a commentary on the news. And let's talk about Shang-Chi, this movie that came out for Marvel. Oh my gosh, guys, this is a great example of Shakespeare and how it can enrich your lives, right? You can certainly live your life without knowing Shakespeare, without watching Shakespeare, but you will live your life better if you do know Shakespeare. For example, you know, my kids were looking at me, what are you doing, Dad? Why are you freaking out during our viewing of Shang-Chi on Saturday? Because about halfway through the movie, Ben Kingsley comes out, right? And this is Ben Kingsley, who, of course, started with the Royal Shakespeare Company over there, played Hamlet in that famous 1976 production. And Ben Kingsley comes out, and he's playing Falstaff in this movie. It's amazing. I mean, they don't call him Falstaff, but he's a jester. He's advising the young king on how he should become more powerful, on how he should advance, giving him all these life lessons. He's a criminal. He associates with criminals. They even call him a jester in the first scene, right? Awkwafina, she did a great job, and her Katie character is like, you know, she calls him a jester. He's clearly being Falstaff. He even goes so far as later in the movie, and I will have a few minor spoilers in here, so I apologize for that. But later in the movie, Falstaff, well, it's not really the Falstaff character. It's Ben Kingsley's character, Trevor. But this Falstaff character, he even plays dead on the battlefield. How Shakespearean can you get right there? And then he's constantly talking about acting, and he's constantly talking about people reacting to acting and reacting to a play. It just certainly enriched the movie. It was fantastic. I loved it. Just absolutely delightful. Unfortunately, the movie kind of just lets that dissipate and lets that go away. You don't get a eulogy for Kingsley's character like you would get for Falstaff and Henry V. And that's kind of the way that the movie goes in some other respects too. The movie clearly is set up right to have this sort of woke message of turning Shang-Chi away from the patriarchy and toward the matriarchy. His dad is the evil character, and his mom represents everything that is good. Not only his mom, but also his aunt and Katie and his sister. And basically every character that is wise, and not in a foolish sort of way, like Trevor, like Kingsley's character, but actually wise and actually powerful, that would be a female character, whereas all the male characters, with the exception of Shang-Chi, those are evil characters. Those are like Razor Fist or the big evil guy, his dad, who's in charge of the Ten Rings. And it's just not especially clean at the end. You know, Orson Scott Card, he wrote Ender's Game, and Orson Scott Card says that your main character has to be, or ought to be, the character who feels the most pain and the character whose decisions matter the most. And Shang-Chi is not that character. That would really be his sister. And you can feel this movie really trying to pull toward his sister a lot, trying to move toward his sister and make her the main character. But it can't because it's sort of trapped in the Marvel history. Which, by the way, speaking as a Marvel fan from back in the day, the idea of Shang-Chi destroying or even going up against the Dweller in Darkness, that's kind of like the idea of Shang-Chi going up against Galactus, right? That doesn't quite match up, but that's okay. Overall, a fun movie, even if artistically some of its metaphors are not carried through completely consistently and logically. It had that in common with Cruella, right? Cruella earlier this year, you had the makers of the movie undermining their own woke message to some extent because, right, Cruella is unfavorably compared to Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Terminator scene. And Cruella, you know, she just looks so weak compared to Terminator in that scene because they won't let her off the leash. They won't let her be fully evil. And then, of course, you know, Cruella has to get saved by the white guy, which again undermines the woke message there. And I'm not in favor of the woke message or looking at movies through a gender lens or a racial lens, but that is clearly the way these movies demand to be looked at. That is how they want to be looked at. They are being made with that in mind. And Cruella certainly sort of betrayed itself there. And at the end, with the patriarchy versus the matriarchy message, Shang-Chi, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it sort of betrays itself too with the way things turn out with his dad and Shang-Chi, certainly turning toward the matriarchy, but it doesn't exactly show any kindness or any forgiveness for the patriarchy. So a little bit of self-betrayal there. Overall, good fun movie though. Popcorn was excellent. I recommend it. Next item for our commentary on the news here. There's a lot of RSV going around this summer, right? Respiratory syncytial virus. And my comment here, in case you're not aware of it, is that this would represent the tip of a very potentially ugly and harmful iceberg. This is the idea of immunity debt. How significant and how real is immunity debt going to be? Well, we don't know. We are in an unprecedented situation right here. But immunity debt is the idea that because everybody locked down for the past year, everybody was basically like Howie Mandel and wrapping their hands in gloves and their faces in masks for the past year. That there's some immunity development that should have happened, especially among the younger population, that did not happen. And that's why we're seeing, like in this AP article here that I'm looking at in Wisconsin, an explosion in cases, according to University of Wisconsin pediatrician Greg DeMurray, saying that we're having an explosion of respiratory syncytial virus cases, which of course is more dangerous, results in more hospitalizations, more fatalities. Than influenza for the younger set. This is a very dangerous virus per case. And as a result, people are worried, right? Normally, this is a very seasonal virus. And I looked at the numbers here to check Greg DeMurray, our pediatrician from University of Wisconsin. And it is true, certainly, that we are having a summer explosion of cases. Now, the numbers in University of Wisconsin are actually, or the numbers in the state of Wisconsin are actually really only about their peak for the winter season. So it's not like we're having a outbreak that is orders of magnitude above what you see in the winter sometimes, but it is extremely unusual to see this in the summer. It is normally a winter thing. What does this foretell for the winter season? We're not sure. Also, the numbers are still going up here in the summer, so it is possible that we could surpass the normal winter caseload, including fatalities, unfortunately. So we don't know. We will see. It's something to keep an eye on. Also, the numbers are actually worse in some other nations. For example, in Tokyo right now, this is actually an article from the November 2021 Infectious Diseases Journal, 2021. Yes, November 2021. This is an early release article. But Mugen Ujiye, excuse me, I am probably butchering that name. I'm sorry. I did take 2 years of Japanese in college, but it didn't give me the kanji or the hiragana when I read this article. It just gave me the romaji. So Mugen Ujiye, he did a study here in Tokyo, and I think he's with Todai University of Tokyo, and he found the cumulative number of cases through week 28 in 2021 of respiratory syncytial virus, 10,327. And how does that compare to 2020? 570. Haha. So in this case, it is an order of magnitude increase, right? This is about a 20 times increase in Tokyo in respiratory syncytial virus cases. That's outrageous increase, an order of magnitude increase. And I sure hope that we are not and for the same thing here. We will see what happens, but keep your eye on that. Next item for our commentary in the news segment here, Michael K. Williams passed away. Rest in peace. He was the actor who played Omar Little on The Wire, a fantastic series, probably a drug overdose. This is obviously a shame, a terrible disappointment. We extend our condolences. The comment here, too, is that, you know, the opioid crisis and drug overdoses are often blamed for the United States' decline in life expectancy over the past few years. And certainly that's involved, but that's a little bit like blaming difficulty in breathing instead of the SARS virus for COVID deaths. Yes, it's certainly there, but I'm not sure how much more progress you're going to make by just focusing on that, banning just the opioids, banning drugs. I mean, we banned alcohol. How well did that work out in this country? We're banning drugs right now. How well is that going? The problem is deeper, right? The problem is deeper. But we don't seem to be learning the lesson about that. For example, San Francisco, well, rather San Jose and Los Angeles are emulating or copying San Francisco. Did you see this? San Jose and Los Angeles are about to enact a ban on flavored tobacco and vaping products. You should check, Los Angeles and San Jose, you should check how well San Francisco's ban on that has done. Well, guess what? After San Francisco banned it, underage smoking rates increased. In fact, we had double the odds of underage smoking relative to concurrent changes in other districts, according to a Yale study here by Abigail Friedman. Way to go, San Francisco. You doubled the odds of underage smoking, teenage smoking, after banning flavored tobacco and vaping products. Clearly, that wasn't the intention, but it was the effect of your ban. I wish that San Jose and Los Angeles would take that into account, but obviously they aren't. And another actor also passed away yesterday, Jean-Paul Belmondo, or over the weekend, I should say. Jean-Paul Belmondo, of course, is the French New Wave actor. He played Michel in A Bout de Souffle, which is translated as Breathless. And unfortunate, right? Jean-Paul Belmondo is kind of like the James Dean of French cinema. I love French New Wave cinema, right? You should watch Mon Amour, or at least you should read the Marguerite Duras script for it, the dialogue there. The movie's basically just all dialogue anyway. Fantastic stuff. And of course, Les Quatre Cents Coupes, the 400 blows, just exquisite. And then Eric Rohmer with L'amour l'après-midi, L'amour l'après-midi, Chloe in the Afternoon was how it was translated in the United States, I believe. Chris Rock remade that one, right, in 2007 with I Think I Love My Wife. Strongly recommend those. And again, rest in peace, Jean-Paul Belmondo, a legend of cinema. All right, it's quiz time. It is quiz time. I've been doing quizzes for 25 years in the classroom, and I'm not going to stop now. Yesterday was Labor Day, so here we go. If you're not familiar, E. Paul Torrance said that one of the marks of the creative mind is its ability to be flexible. He also included fluency and elaboration, originality, some other measures like that, but we're going to focus on flexibility right now. So in how many different ways can you think of the word labor? Yesterday was Labor Day, so our word for today is labor. You will see how it goes. Basically, the rules are, like, if I say the word low and cattle, you say, oh, cattle can low, they can moo. Or if I say low and dance floor, you think, oh, as low as in what Shorty got. So that is their different meanings, the word low right there. So today our word is labor. Your first clue is mucking out the Augean stables. All right, that was a pretty easy one. The correct answer there is Hercules, right? That was the fifth labor of Hercules, the fifth labor of Hercules to clean out the Augean stables. Number two, your word is labor for today. And the second clue is 1594, Ferdinand, the King of Navarre, and the Princess of France and King Navarre is doing a reverse Lysistrata. All right, that's enough time for you. You can always hit the pause button if you want to think of it. But the correct answer for the reverse Lysistrata in 1594 is Love's Labor's Lost. Love's Labor's Lost by Shakespeare, of course. One of his early comedies, and the men try to go without sex there, right? Lysistrata, of course, the famous Aristophanes play where the women try to end the Peloponnesian war by withholding sex from the men. So Love's Labor's Lost, in some sense, a reverse Lysistrata there. Number three clue. We've got three more clues to go here. Our third clue is, remember our word is labor, our third clue is Canada. All right, Labrador, the province Labrador was your correct answer there because it comes from labor. Most likely, the Portuguese explorer Gaspar Corturial, I apologize for murdering some of these names. I did not take 2 years of Portuguese in college. Somewhat questionable origin, according to Edom Online, but probably this land was called Terra Laboratoris, and the Portuguese explorer brought back slaves from there. And so the province of Labrador probably comes from the word labor. There you have it. And next, your fourth clue, the penultimate clue today. The word is labor, and your clue is Keir Starmer, or I suppose Jeremy Corbyn. Yes, that is correct. That is the leader of the Labour Party in Britain. Maybe an easy one there. By the way, Keir was also the name of the first Labour Party leader, 1905, I think it was. So they've come full circle there in 116 years. Finally, our fifth clue, the last clue for the word labor. See if you can get it. The clue is Rachel Plummer. Rachel Plummer, of course, in 1839, she died in labor. Very sad, or shortly thereafter. But Rachel Plummer, by the way, of course, was the amazing woman who was taken by Comanches and lived among the Comanches for a year and a half, published an amazing account of that. Strongly recommend you read it. Talks about all kinds of horrificness and makes you appreciate how far we have come since 1839 in all aspects of civilization, really. It's an eye-opener. Go read Rachel Plum's account of life as a slave in the Comanches, among the Comanches in 1839. She only lived to be 20 years old. Very sad. Let's go on now. Finish up with some news items here. Number five, Biden approval ratings down to 44% in new ABC Washington Post poll. That was 46 to 48%, hovering around there in the 538 aggregate polls. You know, what can you say here? He has let the employment benefits expire. He's had the Afghan debacle, and that's depressing his approval ratings. I am sure that his infrastructure bill is aimed at boosting those numbers. But as Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with that approach, the problem with socialism, is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money. On the other hand, with those unemployment benefits expiring, maybe my local McDonald's will be open past 4 p.m. now. That's right. Every time I go to McDonald's, I see a new sign up there. For a long time, they were closing at 8 p.m. Yesterday, they closed at 4 p.m. About 10 million people in the United States, by the way, losing some form of Benny's. 7.5 million people basically losing all unemployment benefits yesterday, and about 3 million people losing $300 weekly supplement, if you're wondering about that. In sports over the weekend, Shelby Rogers had that amazing upset victory over number one seed Ash Barty in the U.S. Women's Tennis Open. But then Shelby Rogers crashed and lost in the fourth round. She only won three games, lost to Emma Raducanu. And then Shelby said that she's going to get about 9 million death threats on social media. Shelby, my advice would be to stay off of social media then. You can do it. It is not impossible. But that should not happen. Everybody should be kind to Shelby. But Shelby, if you're really getting 9 million death threats, that's going to weigh on you. Stay off of social media. I, of course, have received death threats also via social media, or via email at least. And it's not fun. It really isn't. But you have to be brave, Shelby. You have to keep going. We need more bravery in our country. Also in sports over the weekend, the United States tied Canada in a home game. We should have won. Unfortunately, the United States did not. They had no idea how to play with the lead. And Serginho Dest, our amazing left back, went out of the game with an injury. So we can only hope for improvement there. Well, that's about 20 minutes, so we're going to move into our deep dive. Tomorrow we will get into the Steven Pinker versus Martin Rees debate and how that will be settled, or when it will be settled and what would constitute its settling. I can't wait to talk about that, but we are going to have to put that off till tomorrow because we have our deep dive coming up, our second half of the program. We're going to get into a one big idea discussion. Now, we have a theme this week for our one big idea portion of the program, and that theme is what is unseen. This phrase, of course, what is unseen and seeing what is unseen, comes to us from the French economist Frédéric Bastiat, and he had the parable of the window. I'm going to tell you the parable of the window really quickly because it is so important for understanding how the world works, really. So Bastiat said that imagine there is a baker, and his kid is fooling around, and he busts the baker's window, shatters it right out there, throws his ball through it, the window is shattered into pieces. So now the baker has to go to the glass maker, the glazier, and he has to buy a new window, and he has to get it set in there. And a lot of people will say, oh, this is great business for the glass maker. This is wonderful. He has 6 francs in his pocket now, so breaking the window really helped the glass maker. That is wonderful. Yeah. To some extent, or to full extent, that is absolutely true. That is what is seen, right? Bastiat's essay is, I think it's titled, That's Which Is Seen and That Which Is Unseen. And what is seen is that the glazier does get 6 francs in his pockets. Absolutely true. But what is unseen is if the kid hadn't broken the window in the first place, silly little kid, then the baker would have kept the 6 francs, would have spent it on something else and had a window. So he would have still had the window, and maybe he would have added a book to his library. Maybe he would have gotten his shoes cobbled. Maybe he would have been able to experiment and invent some new delicious type of confectionery to sell in his patisserie there. There could be any number of uses of that 6 francs other than the replacing the window. So the moral of the story is that you have to see what is unseen. Sure, you can just say, oh, it's great to break a window because it increases business. You know, the glassmaker gets 6 francs. But what's not seen is that if the window hadn't been broken, then that 6 francs would have been spent on something else, and the world still would have had a window and that 6 francs of value in something else. So that's why we're focusing on what is unseen. And I want to bring to everyone's attention some of the great unseen projects, unseen developments in history. Sometimes you hear that question. I certainly heard it in the classroom all the time. Where's my flying car? In the 1950s, everybody was promised about flying cars. Where's my moon base? In the 1960s, everybody was talking about a moon base. How come I don't have a base on the moon? Well, I'll tell you why. I don't have an answer for the flying car, by the way, but I do have an answer for the moon base and the Mars base. There is a very good reason. If we see what is unseen, if we look at what hasn't been done, you can answer that question pretty explicitly. It's Project Orion. Some of you already know about Project Orion. It's Project Orion that was abandoned in the 1960s. I'm going to go over the whole history here for you so that if you're not familiar with Project Orion, you can become familiar, and I'm going to give you some details here so even if you are familiar with Project Orion, you can understand exactly the magnitude of what we are missing. You can see what is unseen and what we don't have. We don't have a moon base. We don't have a Mars base. Why not? All right, guys. First, you have to understand that the reason we don't have a moon base and a Mars base is our choice. We have chosen to turn away from a technology that we might not be totally sure would have gotten us moon base or Mars base, but it sure looks like it would have. When we launch a rocket, we use chemical propulsion. In other words, we react the liquid oxygen and the other fuel there in just a chemical reaction, an exchange of electrons, and that provides propulsion for the rocket to zoom up into space. It's not an especially great means of propulsion. Sure, it can get us up into space, but it has a very low specific impulse, which means that the mass of the fuel required compared to the amount of thrust you get out of that fuel is not good. It's not a good ratio, and it takes a ton of conventional propulsion fuel, chemical fuel, to get from our surface up out of our gravity well to orbit. And then once you're in space, it's not especially great, it's not especially efficient at moving through space either. Our chemical propulsion system is not too good. What is the alternative? The alternative that we have chosen not to explore as a society, as a civilization, and that we have chosen not to use is nuclear propulsion. And of course, nuclear propulsion is based on reactions that are not simply exchanges of electrons. Nuclear propulsions, whether you're talking fission bombs or fusion bombs, you're talking about getting energy out of the nucleus of the atoms, the protons and the neutrons. Fission, splitting them apart. If you're above the iron on the binding energy curve, you split it apart, that's fission. You're below iron, you fuse them together, you get energy out, that is a fusion reaction. This provides a tremendous amount of energy. And this is going to sound crazy if you've never heard about it before, but it's true. And it was studied by some of the greatest physicists of the 20th century. In the 1950s and 1960s, we had designs on the board. It's called the Orion Project. You can go back and look it up. NASA did rename another project, by the way. by the Orion Project in the aughts, I believe. And so you have to make sure you get the nuclear pulse propulsion version of the Orion Project when you do look it up. The nuclear pulse propulsion, it sounds crazy, but this was a ship that they were going to drop nuclear bombs out the back of, explode the nuclear bombs after they fell out the backside of the ship, and ride the shockwaves of the nuclear bombs up out of Earth's gravity. Or if you're already in outer space, you eject the nuclear bomb off the back of your spaceship, let it explode, and then you ride the shockwave forward. Now, if you've never heard this idea before, you might think it's crazy. It is not crazy. You had people like Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. He was one of the lead researchers on this. You had massive amounts of government money flowing in to research this. You can go find the videos of the very early tests on pulse propulsion. Pulse propulsion means you drop a bomb out the back of your rocket, let it explode, and ride the shockwave up. You can find videos for the tests of this from national labs like Los Alamos. And you can find those videos online. So go look them up. It is not crazy at all, even though it absolutely sounds crazy to ride nuclear bomb blasts up into space. It turns out that it had a very good chance of working. Would it have worked? We don't know for sure. We never followed all the tests through, so we don't know for sure that it would have worked. But it sure looked like it might have. Those, you can find the early videos. They're not with nuclear bombs, but with conventional explosives. You can find those early videos with conventional explosives. And that rocket goes up. It moves up. And, of course, people took this very seriously. And I'll get to the numbers in a second. But first, let me tell you why we stopped doing it, why we stopped pursuing this. The answer is fear. People got afraid. They were afraid of nuclear bombs. They were afraid of nuclear explosions. And so in 1963... the State Department for the United States signed the Partial Test Ban Treaty. And the Partial Test Ban Treaty was meant to stop nuclear war. It was meant to avert a nuclear war catastrophe, right? We were just coming off the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the Partial Test Ban Treaty banned any explosion above ground, pretty much, in the atmosphere or in outer space. Banned any other nuclear explosion that could send debris into another state's territory, which because of the way, the fallout drifts, and you can detect an isotope, you know, anywhere, right? So we're really good at detecting things. So basically any explosion is going to drift across the globe into another state's territory at some point. So that treaty in 1963 effectively banned the research that they were doing on the Orion Project. You can only imagine that Freeman Dyson and all these other guys, they looked up and they said, "What? You just signed what? Are you kidding me? We've got a chance to get a moon base and a Mars base. This is the only known propulsion method that has a high enough specific impulse to get us to do this. And you just banned it outright." And then the State Department says, "Yep, that's what we did. Sorry." I don't think they even cared. You know, I don't think they even understood the magnitude of what they were doing. I think that they probably thought that chemical, conventional propulsion was going to be enough. But of course, we have seen now in the subsequent 60 years that chemical propulsion was not enough. We don't have a moon base. We don't have a Mars base. We're not even close to it. You just can't very easily at all get there. With conventional explosives, you can't get enough mass to protect yourself from the radiation in outer space. That's the other big problem. The two main problems with interplanetary exploration is propulsion and radiation shielding. Water, air, those are not problems, right? They really aren't. You can take up enough water. You can take up enough air. You can recycle them both. We've got that issue solved. That is not anywhere near the problem that radiation shielding and that propulsion are. And of course, those two problems are interlinked, right? Because to get enough mass up there to shield yourself from radiation on a long interplanetary journey, to get enough mass up there, you need a strong propulsion. You need a lot of force, a lot of thrust, a lot of lift. So In 1963, we signed the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which, by the way, China and France never signed. But anyway, and that banned it. We couldn't do nuclear propulsion anymore. And so it was just put on the shelf, again, out of fear and now out of ignorance. A lot of people don't know how great it could have been. How great could it have been? Well, let me give you some numbers. Basically, you could lift up a city into orbit. If you take the numbers from George Dyson's book, right? George Dyson wrote a book discussing his dad's work and his dad's projects. 800 bombs could lift up about a tenth of an aircraft carrier up into out of Earth's gravity well. So how many bombs is 800 bombs? Well, it's not that many, right? In the peak of the Cold War in the 1980s, the world nuclear stockpile was somewhere around 80,000 warheads. So 800, obviously, you know, just a percent of that. Then that would have been enough to get up a tenth of an aircraft carrier. We're talking, how big is that? Well, that's, you know, several hundred people, right? The staff of an aircraft carrier is in the thousands. So a tenth of that is several hundred people. You could deliver 5,700 tons to the moon, to the surface of the moon, with this nuclear pulse propulsion vehicle, this Orion vehicle. Now, 5,700 tons. Well, how much is that? Let me tell you, the Saturn V rocket, our biggest rocket that we did launch lunar missions with, could deliver about 2 tons. Yes, you heard me right. That's not two. That's not 2,000. That's not 200. That's two. So we're talking a difference of 2 tons versus 5,700 tons. And you could even scale it up, right? You can even go bigger. You could get basically an entire city up there. You could get, if you wanted, megatons and megatons and megatons. In 1968, Freeman Dyson published an article in Physics Today that talked about this. He talked about it not just in terms of interplanetary exploration, but in 1968, he was actually talking about an interstellar arc. And he's talking about a vehicle that is 10 kilometers in radius. 10 kilometers in radius, that's 20 kilometer diameter. Obviously, that's a city. That is a city that you're lifting up. Now, what would it take? It would take a huge amount, right? It would take millions of bombs, 10 to 30 million bombs to lift up there, to lift the city up. But then that city could make it to Alpha Centauri, the nearest star, in roughly 1,000 years. That might seem like a long time if you're not used to thinking in interstellar travel, but it's actually amazing to get a city out there to the nearest star in 1,000 years is just outrageously good. This is the only way really that we know of, and maybe it wouldn't have worked. Maybe it didn't. We don't have full knowledge of this. We did not finish our testing on it because of that 1963, that fateful fall of 1963, fateful in many ways, right? Because that Partial Test Ban Treaty signed in 1963, we really couldn't ever test this. And people have been afraid ever since to go back and revisit a full Orion project. But a smaller version in that 1968 paper, a smaller version could have made it to Alpha Centauri in 100 years. In Freeman Dyson's 1968 paper, you probably could have made it to Alpha Centauri just in a century, albeit with a much smaller ship. So this is absolutely the way to establish interplanetary travel, establish a moon base, establish a Mars base. If this technology works, we could have had moon bases and Mars bases in a snap, just like that, by the 1980s, right? You could have done it. And interstellar travel, we could have a ship heading out to a city of humans heading out to Alpha Centauri right now. Of course, they didn't know, and we still don't know, what the living conditions would be like once we got there. But a city could have headed out with this technology if it worked. What are some of the dangers of this technology, right? The reason that people are so afraid of this technology is obviously, I think, in most people's case, they'd be afraid of the fallout. Now, the estimates by General Dynamics and other people that were working on this was about a tenth to one death from fallout per launch from an interplanetary Orion vehicle. So that's roughly comparable, by the way, to some of the devices that we tested, right? In 1952, we had a 10 megaton device that we tested in the South Pacific. And basically, the launch of an interplanetary vehicle would be on the same order of that. So, yes, it probably would have caused some increased cancer rates around the world and probably a fatality. Probably one person, according to these old studies, which, again, weren't pursued in more detail, and the world population's changed since then. Maybe it's up. Maybe it's 10 additional cancer deaths across. I'm just making that number up at this point. But for argument's sake, for the little Gedankensatz, the thought experiment here, 10 fatalities increased around the world. Would you take a moon base? Would you take a star base? A Mars base for that? Maybe you would. I don't know, right? We have 30 to 40,000 people killed by gasoline propulsion, right? Traffic deaths around our country right now, 30,000 to 40,000 people. And for this Mars base, you're talking one fatality, even increase by an order of magnitude to be extremely conservative. Now 10 increase cancer fatalities per launch. I don't know, around the world. I don't know if you would make that deal. You can decide. I'm just giving you the numbers. The other danger now, of course, besides cancer deaths, increased rate of cancer around the world, would be an EMP, right? An electromagnetic pulse. They didn't worry about this in the 60s because they didn't have integrated circuits all around the world in the 1960s. But now, of course, it would be a concern. Electromagnetic pulse has about 100 kilometer footprint. So you actually probably could avoid that if you went out to a remote area. But it is a concern, and of course there is the other concern that you would probably be flooding the Van Allen belts with radiation. If you were really careful about it, maybe you could avoid that, and we're not totally sure what effect that would have, right, by flooding the Van Allen belts with radiation. Who knows? But the point is that we stopped studying it. And that's the reason there is no Mars base. That's the reason there is no moon base. Because we signed the test ban treaty, nuclear partial test ban treaty in 1963, and we never pursued nuclear pulse propulsion technology, which would have, if it worked, pretty easily led to a moon base and a Mars base. If it worked, which we don't know. All right, folks, that's going to be about the wrap for today. Let's just go over. We went over the news. We talked about the Shang-Chi movie. We talked about the matriarchy versus the patriarchy. And then, and of course, read your Shakespeare so you can appreciate movies like that. We talked about RSV in Wisconsin and Tokyo and what could be on the horizon for RSV. We talked about the unfortunate passing of two amazing actors. We did our quiz on Labor Day, and of course we finished up with our one big idea. Our one big idea, what you're missing. And today, what you're missing, what is unseen, as Basquiat would say, is our moon base, our Mars base. You're not seeing it because we have chosen, out of fear, to not do nuclear propulsion technology. Maybe that fear is justified, maybe it is not. But you should make an informed, educated decision about whether that fear is justified. Tomorrow, we're going to get into the Pinker versus Rees bet on long bets. We will discuss that. We'll see who's going to win. I will make my own prediction. Love Steven Pinker. Love Martin Rees. We will see what happens tomorrow. I will talk to you then. Have a wonderful day.